This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is Gene Autry calling all cowboys. Calling all cowboys. Go to Bidwell Ranch at once. Rustler's headed that way. Calling all cowboys.
That's Gene Autry in his 1937 film Public Cowboy No. 1, using his radio broadcast to call for help in catching the cattle rustlers. It's not the only one of his films in which he had a radio show. Gene Autry was the first singing cowboy movie star. He influenced Westerns, country music, and Western clothing. Frankly, much as I love Westerns, I didn't pay much attention to him as a kid, but a few years ago, I learned what a great singer he was. I've been watching his film Sundays on the Encore Western Channel. Turner Classic Movies is showing singing cowboy films every Friday night this month, with 5 back-to-back Gene Autry movies this Friday. So we asked Holly George Warren to talk with us about Gene Autry. She's the author of the Autry biography, Public Cowboy No. 1. She also wrote Cowboy, How Hollywood Invented the Wild West, and co-authored How the West Was Worn. I told you how much I like Autry's singing. In his movies, he didn't just do cowboy songs, he did some pop songs too, like this one, Someday You'll Want Me to Want You, from his 1946 film, Sioux City Sioux.
When I'm in love with somebody else, you expect me to be true and keep on loving you, though I am feeling blue. You think I can't forget you until someday you'll want me to want you. When I am strong for somebody new, and though you don't want me now, I'll get along somehow, and then I won't want you. I know that someday you'll want me to want you.
Holly George Warren, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
You know, it's so interesting in the Gene Autry singing cowboy movies, there's often like a radio show that fits into it, you know, because Gene Autry is always playing a character called Gene Autry. And usually he's not only singing with the boys on the trail and singing to his sweetheart, he's also singing on the radio, or he's singing in a rodeo, or singing in a medicine show. But they're always, in their own way, kind of showbiz-oriented.
They're showbiz-oriented, and the other new thing in these movies was that often they took place in the present day. Usually the Westerns took place in the 19th century. And in these films, even though Gene was always riding Champion, his horse, and there were plenty of lots of, you know, Western things everywhere, but there were cars, there were airplanes, the bad guys were often either corporate guys trying to wipe out the little man on the range, or, you know, gangsters from back east and things like that. So, of course, radio was part of that modern day period that they were depicting in these films.
There were often women from the city who'd come in to, like, the ranch with high heels on.
Exactly.
And there's, like, you know, there's Gene Autry in his, like, Western outfit on his horse and everything. So you had those two worlds colliding. It's always interesting to see in the Gene Autry Westerns how they were going to work in radio in those Westerns where they did work it in. So I want to play an example. One of his better-known movies is called Melody Ranch. And in this one, you know, Ann Miller, who's a star of musical movies, is in it. Jimmy Durante, the famous comic, is in it. So here's a scene in which, you know, Gene Autry actually has his own radio show, and his friend Jimmy, played by Jimmy Durante, has lost a court fight against the villains who run the town. And Gene is on Durante's side, and here's Gene Autry in the court after the verdict.
All right, Your Honor. I'm forced to respect the law, even the way it's handed out in Torpedo.
Court adjourned.
Cheer up, Genie boy. You might be able to use that story on your radio program sometime. You'll have to rewrite the script so you'll be the noble hero that scares off all the bold bad men.
Bud, you're a scream. You're terrific, my brother.
Thanks, boys. You just gave me a swell idea. Listen in on my program tomorrow night and you'll hear a story about the law and torpedo. And so will everybody else in the country.
I wouldn't use that material if I was Eugene.
You may be running this town right now, Mark, but you're not running my radio program.
I just think it's so funny because, like, the conflict isn't about, like, the cattle drive in the scene. It's about, you know, the radio program.
And, yes, the radio show actually was almost like a character of Gene Autry films from the very beginning. He was in a serial called Phantom Empire, which is this just amazing sci-fi Western. And the whole crux of the matter was if he didn't arrive at the ranch each day called the Radio Ranch to do his broadcast, then they would lose the ranch. And throughout his career, the radio plays an important role. And that was the other aspect of the Gene Autry films. He always played himself. Gene Autry, radio star, singing star. And even if he was a sheriff, he was Gene Autry, the singing, you know, sheriff. And sometimes even the radio would be used to save the day to alert his friends like Smiley Burnett where the bad guys were hiding. Or sometimes he would use a phonograph record. It would be playing as a way to trick the bad guys. They would think he was in the other room singing and it was really, you know, the phonograph record. So he definitely incorporated all those other parts of his career into his movies.
For the movie Melody Ranch that we just heard a clip from, the studio hired Julie Stein, the great songwriter who later wrote the music for the shows Gypsy, Funny Girl, Bells Are Ringing, the music for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So he wrote the melodies for this movie. And one of them, I just love this song, so I thought we'd play it. It's called Melody Ranch, and it's the title song for the film, and Gene Autry later named his ranch Melody Ranch. It's so interesting the way it opens the film, because the film opens with this song and it's later reprised at the end where he's singing it to his sweetheart. But in the opening of the film, Gene Autry and the boys are sitting around a campfire singing this song. Then Gene Autry gets up, the camera pulls back, and we see he's walking toward a microphone. And the campfire isn't real. It's a set for his radio program.
Right.
So it's just so interesting, again, how they get radio and the West to figure into the same movie. But anyways, I want to play this song, Melody Ranch. I have to say the lyrics don't quite measure up to the melody.
That's true sometimes.
But, you know, his singing's so good, so relaxed, kind of behind the beat. So here's Gene Autry with Ann Miller singing Melody Ranch.
Stake your claim on Melody Ranch with a song. As you ride neath the moon side by side, let a tune be your guide. Stake your claim on Melody Ranch with a song. Harmonize, learn the words, vocalize with the birds in the sky. You'll find your love.
That's Gene Autry with Ann Miller from the movie Melody Ranch, which of course starred Gene Autry. And we're talking to Holly George Warren, who's the author of a book about Gene Autry, which is called Public Cowboy Number One. And on Friday, July 8th, TCM is going to be playing several Gene Autry Western musicals back-to-back. But also, if you like Gene Autry films, the Encore Western Channel shows them every Sunday at noon. So we just heard Melody Ranch, very nice. These movies that Gene Autry made, he did so many of them. How many did he do?
He was in about 93 films altogether.
That's really a lot. And you said there are periods where he would do a movie a month. Now, okay, these are low-budget films, and, you know, some of them kind of adhere to a formula. Still a movie a month? And they were short. Some of them were like an hour and 10 minutes. Nevertheless, that seems kind of ambitious or really cranking it out.
Yeah. Before James Brown, I think, and Elvis Presley, but I think Gene Autry was the hardest working man in show business. I mean, the guy sometimes made 8 films a year. He was doing a national radio show that began in 1940, so that was a weekly show. He did public appearances all over, traveled around with a Western variety show, and he was always in the recording studio. He was a Columbia Records artist, so he was working in the studios in California and New York. And then later on, he was the first of the Western film stars to get onto TV. He started his own production company in 1950 and started doing a weekly TV show as well.
Now, he started off working on the railroad and singing. Mm-hmm. How did the railroad help him get started in its own way?
Well, back in those days, we're talking mid to late 20s, he worked for the Frisco Railroad, which had stops up and down Oklahoma, Missouri, and it was really a very family atmosphere. They had their own newspaper, so I was able to find copies of the Frisco Railroad newspaper touting this great, you know, railroad telegrapher. He was a telegraph operator who entertained his friends and coworkers by performing for them. And he also started doing a local show in Tulsa where he performed on the radio and started doing a few little shows around in that area. So it kind of built up his confidence until he finally got his recording career started in 1929, actually October of 29. Not the most auspicious time to start a recording career, but that's when he went to New York and cut his first records.
Yeah, his first records coincided with the crash that led to the Great Depression.
Right. And it was just kind of one of those perfect timing things because Gene had this very kind of like everyman quality to him, and recording had changed so that he had a soft, kind of an intimate way of singing. It was much like, say, Bing Crosby did, and with the new type of microphones, this was perfect for Gene's voice. And the other thing was Gene was a real mimic, and he could do songs like a very popular singer, Jimmy Rogers, which was a big seller for Victor Records back in the day and were selling for 75 cents a record. Gene started doing kind of Jimmy Rogers sound-alikes for 20 cents a record at these budget discount labels, and they started selling like hotcakes because people in rural areas could order these from mail-order catalogs. And he built up a big audience that way through really kind of, you know, the budget chains of the day.
Well, you mentioned Jimmy Rogers, and it's understandable why Gene Autry would want to emulate Jimmy Rogers, because Jimmy Rogers was not only a great singer and songwriter, but he also was a railroad man like Gene Autry was.
Exactly. And in fact, when I did research for the book, thank goodness there was all this correspondence that Gene had kept going back to the early 40s. And through a lot of detective work, I figured out that that Gene and Jimmy actually did meet a few times. And then, of course, when Jimmy Rogers died, sadly, of TB, Gene recorded, I think it was 3 or 4 tribute songs to Jimmy Rogers. And it was really quite touched by the man.
Well, let's hear one of the Jimmy Rogers imitation budget label recordings, one of the knockoffs that Gene Autry did very early in his career in 1929. And this is Blue Yodel number 5. You say this is basically like gesture for gesture, note for note replication of Jimmy Rogers.
Yes, and it was so strange, Terry, because he ended up actually recording some Jimmy Rogers songs that Rogers did at Victor and releasing them even before Rogers' own versions came out. I think that he, you know, was able to get the lead sheets for and the sheet music for some of these songs. And then also he actually saw some of Jimmy Rogers' performances, learned the songs, and then rushed into the studio and did the budget version of it. And it actually came out either the same week or even before Rogers in a couple of cases.
All right, so here's Gene Autry in 1929 singing Jimmy Rogers' Blue Yodel number 5.
Storming on the deep blue sea, loud it's raining, yeah. Storming on the deep blue sea, there ain't no black-headed mama can make a fool out of me. Old lady, hey, lady. Now I can see a train coming down the river. railroad track. Lord, 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 I can see a train coming down the railroad track. And I love to hear the bark of that old smokestack. Old lady, hey, lady. Holy old lady. Holy old lady. Holy old lady. Lady, lady, old lady. Talk about your trouble.
So that's Gene Autry singing Jimmy Rogers' Blue Yodel No. 5, recorded very early in Autry's career, 1929, and recorded in a much higher voice than we're used to hearing him.
Yes, he did these crazy, I love them actually, these rambling, gambling kind of, you know, songs that were the antithesis to the white-hatted good guy that Gene played in the Western movies. You know, these were about loose women and boozing it up and things like that.
So how did Gene Autry find his own voice after imitating Jimmy Rogers?
Well, he was billed early on as the Oklahoma yodeling cowboy because he did, you know, grow up in Texas and Oklahoma. And by the time he made his way to Chicago to star on WLS, which was a huge radio station and had the National Barn Dance in 1932, his announcer, a woman named Ann Williams, started really building up. Here comes our hero cowboy, Gene Autry. And they would do the whole clippity-clappity, you know, of him riding up and really inspiring him to start dressing more in cowboy outfits, because before that he just dressed, you know, in a nice business suit when he did public appearances. So he really started taking on this guise as the cowboy, even though he knew what it was really like to be a cowboy, having come from Texas and Oklahoma, and that it was really drudgery and hard work in reality. So, of course, he started emphasizing the fantasy, the beauty of being a cowboy, and the heroicism of being a cowboy. So by 1933, he had begun recording strictly cowboy songs, along with still a few of the Jimmy Rogers-style rambling, gambling songs.
Had he ever been a cowboy? Had he ever rode horses before being in movies?
Well, he grew up in, you know, rural Texas, so you pretty much had to be able to ride a horse. I think, sadly, he probably rode a mule more often because he came from very impoverished background, and his father deserted the family when he was quite young. But his uncle ran a small ranch in Texas, and he helped a lot on the ranch and definitely knew how to, you know, drive a cart, you know, with horse and ride a horse. But he was by no means an expert horseman, and he certainly did not want to be. I mean, it's kind of ironic when he did make it out in California in the movies in 1935, he had to take a lot of lessons and really train to learn how to be good on horseback.
Of course, one of the songs Gene Autry became most famous for is Back in the Saddle Again. Did he use that as the theme on his radio show?
Yes. Gene was very shrewd. He did not write that song. A guy named Ray Whitley wrote it, and it actually appeared in a film that Whitley was in around 1938. But Gene loved the song, and maybe, you know, he was a great stylist, so maybe he changed it a little bit with the way he sang it. But before long, his name was on the writing credits, and he ended up getting the publishing to the song. Once that happened, it became the theme song to his radio show.
Clever, because you get a lot of money when people buy
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So let's hear Back in the Saddle Again. And I have to say, I always thought of this as just like a really corny song, but it's really lovely the way he sings it. So here's Gene Autry.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly Jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-a, I go my way. Back in the saddle again.
Holly, where would you say Gene Autry fits into country music? And what impact would you say he had on subsequent country music performers?
Gene Autry had a huge impact on the history of country music. Prior to his popularity, most of the kind of music considered country or country and western was labeled hillbilly music or old-time tunes, that kind of thing. And for example, the music that was popular in Nashville, there was kind of a hayseed image surrounding the music. Most of the performers even dressed kind of in these overstated outfits with the overalls and the patches and the blacked-out teeth sometimes, that kind of thing, to really give it that rural flavor. When Gene came along basically singing country songs for a national audience on the movies beginning in 35, he was dressed up as a cowboy, and it had this much more kind of heroic stature than, say, the country bumpkin that country music was associated with. So
and romantic, because he was a leading man.
Yes, it was romantic. He won the day with the music rather than his fists, although he could throw a punch now and again, but it was basically playing guitar and singing that often won the day. And suddenly, national audiences started clamoring for this kind of music. And before, you know, country music had been quite regional with audiences mostly in, you know, pockets of the Midwest, but the Southeast and Texas and places like that. So the popular audience for country music started to expand, and Western music, which had some similarities to it but different themes, of course, with great songs like Tumbling Tumbleweeds and those kind of things, you know, descriptive lyrics about the Western plains, etc. Those kind of lyrics sometimes matched with the more traditional country music, the hillbilly mountain style music, and created what became known as country and Western music in the 1940s.
Do you think that Autry played any role in establishing the clothing style for country music?
Gene played a huge role in that because, again, the country artists who dressed kind of not with a lot of stage presence saw these great cowboy outfits with, you know, the piping and the embroidery and things like that, and they began wearing them on stage. And pretty soon, the stages of the Grand Ole Opry, everybody had on a cowboy hat and boots and you know, a fancy Western shirt.
So Gene Autry actually started his movie career with a serial, a cliffhanger serial of really short movies called Phantom Empire. And this is actually on DVD. So I'm going to read the blurb on the back of the video box because it's concise and perfect. So Gene Autry does a radio show from a place called Radio Ranch. And it says, Radio Ranch is a dude ranch resort owned by Tom Baxter and popular radio entertainer Gene Autry. 25,000 feet beneath the ranch lies the super scientific, highly advanced kingdom of Murania, which is rich in radium deposits and ruled by the beautiful Queen Tika. Gene's radio contract states that he must broadcast daily from the ranch or he will lose it to a discredited scientist trying to steal the ranch for its radium. The Queen tries to protect her kingdom from the outside world by getting rid of Gene Autry and the Junior Thunder Riders. And that's a group of children and teenagers who, well, it's too complicated to explain.
But, well, they have great costumes. Like, they have helmets made out of buckets on their head and, of course, the capes. And it's got all those kind of things like the Little Rascals used to have as far as secret hideouts and secret laboratories. But mixed in with that, we have Gene Autry singing this great country music with his sidekick, Smiley Burnett, who was called Oscar in this particular serial, but later on became known as Frog Milhouse because of his way of making the frog voice and all these kind of funny sound effects and things like that. But it's got an early television, and you know, you figured this was 1934 when they started filming this, and television is a big part of the Queen Tika's artillery of technological advances that she uses to see what the surface people are up to. And there are robots that are just hysterical.
The robots look like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz.
Yes, they do. And one really great part, they get inhabited by Oscar and Pete, the two bumbling sidekicks, which is really quite amusing.
So to give a sense of what this serial sounded like, I thought I'd play a short scene. Gene Autry isn't in the scene, but he's the subject of the scene because the Queen and one of her men are talking about how to get rid of Gene Autry.
There's the key to our entire situation.
Explain yourself, Argo.
If we can capture Gene Autry, Radio Ranch would soon become deserted, and the entrance to our underground kingdom would forever remain undiscovered.
We can never allow Murania to become desecrated by the presence of surface people. Our lives are serene. Our minds are superior. Our accomplishments greater. Gene Autry must be captured.
I'll give you a sense of the great acting
in
that. But this was his breakthrough, huh?
This was. It became hugely popular. And it was interesting, too, that some of the themes that we would later see in the Gene Autry films, kind of like the cowboys versus technology kind of thing. And then also there was a really strong female character, the young girl who was an incredible trick writer, Betsy King Ross, who plays a large role in the film, I think was a big inspiration to a lot of the young girls who were watching the serial on Saturday afternoons.
After Gene Autry became famous, his biggest rival was Roy Rogers. When did Roy Rogers come along?
Well, it's interesting. One of my favorite early Gene films was from 1936 called The Old Corral. And in that film, there's this guy, I don't think he even gets credited, but his name at that time was Dick Weston, and he was a member of the Sons of the Pioneers, a great singing group. And that was Roy Rogers to be. He played actually kind of a bad guy in that Gene turns around and he becomes a good guy in the end. And he actually does a little bit of singing in it, as do the Sons of Pioneers. Well, a couple of years later, in 1938, Gene actually went on strike because he had such a horrific contract with his movie company. I mean, he started out at $100 a week and hadn't gotten that much more, even though he was a huge star. So while he was on strike, literally refusing to go before the cameras, that's when Herb Yates, who ran Republic Pictures, said, okay, we're going to make somebody else a star. And that's when he helped Roy Rogers get the name, Roy Rogers. He was actually born Leonard Sly in Ohio. Anyway, that was his first starring role, was in 1938. And so he then became kind of a little bit of a competition to Gene at that period. But it wasn't really until World War II when Gene served in the military that Roy Rogers became the, you know, king of the cowboys.
So while Gene Autry was serving in the Pacific, Roy Rogers was making movies?
Yeah, I go into a lot of detail in the book about this because I was able to find correspondence. It was pretty unbelievable. Herb Yates really wanted Gene Autry to stay out of the service, and Gene insisted in going in. And Herb Yates, you know, Gene was Republic Pictures' cash cow. He was much more popular than John Wayne even at that point. And so Herb Yates said, okay, forget it. We're going to make somebody else a star. You're never going to work again. And literally, I found correspondence that Herb Yates sent to all the movie theater chains in the country saying, forget Gene Autry. Republic's new cowboy king is Roy Rogers. We only want you to play the Roy Rogers. And of course, Gene wasn't able to make films while he was serving in the Army Air Corps. So suddenly, you know, these Roy Rogers pictures became, you know, number one. He was on the cover of Life magazine. And Gene recovered somewhat when he came back from the war and started making pictures again, but never quite outdid Roy Rogers in popularity after that.
Something that Gene Autry and his rival Roy Rogers shared is that they didn't want their studio to show their movies on TV. What were they afraid of?
Well, what started happening was that people stopped going to the movies to stay home and watch television for free. And, you know, these B-Westerns had always been kind of budget films. A lot of times they were double features and things like that. So they were really afraid that they were undercutting their, you know, the film's value by having them on TV for free. Of course, Gene got very smart and actually ended up buying all of his films from Republic Pictures and was able to then show them on his own television stations because he was also very smart and he got into broadcasting. He started buying radio stations during World War II and later TV stations. So he started showing his own films the way he wanted them to be seen on his own stations.
You know, we've talked about where Gene Autry fits into the movies as a singing cowboy and where his music fits into country music. Where would you say he fits in as a businessman within the entertainment world?
Gene was very savvy early on that the way to make money in music, and a way to sustain an income was through publishing, music publishing. So very, very early, even when he was just singing on the radio in Chicago, he started his own publishing company and started trying to buy copyrights of songs. So that kind of sustained him through some hard times, in World War II, when he was just drawing the pay of a soldier. He was able to make quite a bit of money from the publishing company. And also, shrewdly, he was able to invest in radio stations that would continue to, you know, play his music. During the shellac shortages during World War II, he bought a jukebox company that distributed jukeboxes. So he knew that all the enlisted men and women would be listening to jukeboxes, and also that his records would have to be distributed to go onto these jukeboxes. So he really had a knack for figuring out business, and also he was able to look into the future as far as, you know, getting into television really early, buying up some real estate really early, and, you know, buying TV stations too, when still it was kind of a crapshoot if those were going to really pan out at the time.
Gene Autry retired from public performance in 1962. He died of lymphoma in 1998 at the age of 91. You did a feature story on him for the New York Times. You met him when you wrote that story. What was your impression of him?
It was so incredible. He was 89 years old. I met him in March of 97, and he still had that charisma, you know, even though he was an elderly guy, and, you know, he was funny, he was charming, he definitely liked the ladies. I happened to have a penchant for, you know, Western outfits myself, and I was, of course, decked out in my fanciest cowgirl outfit and my fanciest boots that day when I went to meet him and interview him, and he was quite taken by my outfit and even said, "Honey, did you bring a Kodak with you so we can get some pictures?" And gave me tips on how to keep my boots all shiny. And he was just a really, I could see why so many people loved the guy.
Well, Holly George Warren, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, this has been just a true honor. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Holly George Warren is the author of Public Cowboy No. 1. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. You can see 5 Gene Autry films this Friday night on Turner Classic Movies as part of this month's Singing Cowboy series. The Encore Western Channel shows Autry films every Sunday. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by Dolly Parton, who Ken thinks is often underestimated as a singer and songwriter. This is Fresh Air. Dolly Parton released her first solo album in 1967. Since then, she's become a multimedia star in movies and on television. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Parton's new album, Better Day, returns the focus to Parton's singing and her songwriting, which Ken says has frequently been underestimated.
Now, we don't know what heaven looks like, but we've seen enough hell right here and right now. But when the road is the roughest and the problems are the toughest, or when the times are the hardest, or that old sky turns the darkest, you gotta keep the faith, 'cause I believe there's a better day. And those old blues, why, they're gonna just roll right on away. I know they are. Listen to me. All this blue ain't sky and sea. Some of that blue's bound to get on me. But the blues don't come to stay. They'll move away on a better day. Troubles and woes.
Dolly Parton has spent the past few years reconnecting with country music's past, putting out albums that illustrate her love for bluegrass, 1960-style countrypolitan ballads, and high lonesome harmony. She had all but conceded the commercial mainstream to a younger generation. But with Better Day, she's trying out a different strategy, placing herself very much in the here and now, even talking about the bad economy and the country's restlessness, but framing the music with a positive, upbeat attitude. The song that serves as the manifesto for this is its lead-off track, In the Meantime.
You know, people been talking about the end of time ever since time began. We've been living in the last days ever since the first day, ever since the dawn of man. Some people tell you they do. Well, it might be today, it might be tomorrow, or in a million years or two. In the meantime, in between time, let us make time to make it right. And let us not fear what is not clear. Faith should be your guide. Just follow.
The greatest days we've ever known are the days we're living in, sings Parton on that song, so drop this doomsday attitude, these are wonderful times we're living in. Optimism in the service of heightened realism suits Parton. Her voice has always curled up into a giggle of glee, a bubble of bumptiousness. Her high pitch has frequently been a place to find jaunty novelty songs that match her cartoonish image. But underneath all the glitter and tight dresses, there's always been a skilled songwriter. A technically adept craftsperson who knows how to weave a metaphor throughout the entire fabric of a song. She does this most intriguingly on The Sacrifice, a song about how hard she's worked, rhyming rhinestones with grindstones without a trace of self-pity.
Well, I've sacrificed time with family and friends, gave up vacations for work without end, 24/7, 365. I was willing to make the sacrifice. But empty or full, I've carried my pail. You don't drink the water if you don't dig the well. Through blood, sweat, and tears, I have built a good life. But it didn't come without sacrifice. And I was gonna be rich no matter how much it cost. And I was gonna win.
One of the most lovely songs on Better Day is a deceptively simple love song called Somebody's Missing You. With harmonies by her friends Emmylou Harris and Alison Krauss, Somebody's Missing You is the lullaby to an absent lover, assuring him that the singer is thinking only of him. Parton sings the verses as almost whispered secrets.
Somebody's missing you, longs to be kissing you. You'd better listen, you mean all the world to me. You're on somebody's mind just almost all the time. Bet you already knew somebody's missing you. The days go slow.
Better Day is the album that takes Dolly Parton's sunny smile and makes sure you understand that it's not a Cheshire Cat grin. There's a sincerity and earnest quality to this music that enables it to stand apart from so much of the trumped-up emotionalism and cheesy irony of the pop music world all around it. It may be that, in the words of a song title here, country is as country does, but Parton doesn't just follow country fashion. She makes her own garments and wears them well.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Dolly Parton's new album called Better Day. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that tells the story behind E.B. White's classic children's book, Charlotte's Web. This is Fresh Air. In a poll of librarians, teachers, publishers, and authors, the trade magazine Publishers Weekly asked for a list of the best children's books ever published in the United States. Hands down, the number one book was E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. Now a new book called The Story of Charlotte's Web explores how White's masterpiece came to be. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
One early fall morning in 1949, E.B. White walked into the barn of his farm in Maine and saw a spider web. That in itself was nothing new, But this web, with its elaborate loops and whirls that glistened with the morning dew, caught his attention. Weeks passed until one cold October evening when he noticed that the spider was spinning what turned out to be an egg sac. White never saw the spider again, and so when he had to return later that fall to New York City to his job as a regular contributor to the New Yorker magazine, White took out a razor blade and cut the silken egg sac out of the web. He put the sac in an empty candy box, punched some holes in it, and absent-mindedly put the box atop his bedroom bureau in New York. Weeks later, a movement on that bureau alerted him to the fact that tiny spiderlings were making a great escape through the air holes in the candy box. White was delighted at this affirmation of life and left the hundreds of barn spiderlings alone for the next week or so to spin webs from his hairbrush to his nail scissors to his mirror until finally the cleaning lady complained. Thus was hatched the idea for Charlotte's Web, White's magical meditation on the passage of time, mortality, and the great gift of finding a true friend in this world. However, as Michael Sims tells us in his wonderful new book called The Story of Charlotte's Web, there was also a much longer incubation period for White's classic, a period that began with his isolated childhood as the youngest of seven children, the snappy creative bustle of the New York newspaper world in the 1920s, which gave White his career and his writing role models, and White's own lifelong struggle with anxiety. That anxiety was soothed in part by writing and by the company of animals. All except, that is, for rats. Take that, Templeton. If you love Charlotte's Web, and please, if you don't, just get help now. Sims' lively and detailed excursion into the mystery of how White's classic came to be is a perfect read for this season, full of grass and insects, pigs and summer rain. The first two-thirds or so of The Story of Charlotte's Web recounts White's life up to his 50s when he began writing his masterpiece. Good as it is, the final section of Sims' book is the real revelation, not only about the influences on Charlotte's Web, but about just how hard it was for White to write, despite the fact that his style always seemed effortless. White was encouraged to attempt children's fiction by his wife, Catherine White, who was the fiction editor of The New Yorker and a regular reviewer of children's literature. She'd urged him to write his first children's book, Stuart Little, which was published in 1945 and had taken him over 6 years to write. White also took inspiration from the 1920s newspaper columnist, Don Marquis, who wrote acclaimed stories about a poetic typing cockroach named Archie. White was adamant that, like Archie, his fictional animal characters should not be cute, but should remain true to their predatory, and in the case of Wilbur, their manure-loving, messy nature. White finished the first draft of the novel in 1951, and then let it sit for a year. He said in a letter to his patient editor that, "I've recently finished another children's book, but have put it away to ripen. Let the body heat out of it. It doesn't satisfy me the way it is, and I think eventually I shall rewrite it pretty much." When Charlotte's Web finally came out in October of 1952, most of the reviews were laudatory, except for one, written by Anne Carroll Moore, the influential Children's Division librarian for the New York Public Library. Years earlier, Moore had panned Stuart Little, and now she slammed Charlotte's Web for leaving the human character of Fern undeveloped. White's own later understated estimation of his work is the most touching. In old age, when he was suffering from Alzheimer's, White liked to have his own essays and books read to him. Sometimes White would ask who wrote what he was listening to, and his chief reader, his son Joe, would tell him, "You did, Dad." Sims says that White, would think about this odd fact for a moment and sometimes murmur, "Not bad."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Story of Charlotte's Web by Michael Sims. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.